Welcome to this episode of Shadows from the Tree. We delve into the darker side of genealogy by exploring stories pulled from newspaper archives and using historical records to find the truth behind them. Specifically, this episode focuses on the theme of love triangles and the impact it had on the lives of those involved. Join us as we shed light on these often overlooked stories in hopes of connecting you, our listeners, to their lives. So,
welcome back, Danielle. Yeah,
season two. Here we go.
Yep. Summer break was nice, but we're glad to be back. I feel like I spent a lot of time over the summer researching this one in particular. How about you?
Yeah, no, I definitely spent some time. My plan of action was find an article and just pull the newspaper articles so that when I was ready to research, I was like, had everything there. But no, it was good to have family time, went on a few trips and just enjoyed the summer. So it was a nice break. And I think specifically, we were able to kind of catch up on the social media and we made all the posts for last season's episode. So if you were interested in one of those, you can look back. There's some pictures usually associated with them. And we, you know, made a list of all of the, like, the surnames that we featured in the episodes from last season. And we had, like, over 40, which I think, you know, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a lot of lives that we looked into and, you know, people's ancestors that may find interesting stories about.
Yeah, definitely. Because when I posted it, there was a couple people who would be like, oh, this is my last name. Oh, this is my last name. And then I just kind of just keep reposting them and be like, well, check it out. And maybe you're, you know, you're definitely connected to the story. And we reached our goal, which is also, I think, a big accomplishment for us. So we had wanted to double our listener count, and we did. So we were at, like, what, 1,200?
Yeah, over 1,200 listeners now. So it's very exciting.
Yeah. So thanks for listening, and we hope you continue the journey with us. We are improving season two here with some new equipment.
Yes. We're, you know, there's a learning curve with everything, but it's going to sound much better. So we appreciate everyone listening to season one and hope everyone likes season two even more.
Yeah, thank you. So we're definitely going to be covering some popular dark genealogy themes that we did from season two, as well as some new ones that we find interesting. And yeah, just really hoping to uncover more and more shadows. And the first one is going to be love triangles. So I think this is one we enjoyed from last season.
Yep.
And it was really fun to do. So I'm looking forward to hearing what Michelle found and then sharing my story with her. So shall we get into it?
Yeah, let's get into it. I guess. I'm going first.
All right.
So my story is, you know, love triangle. So of course there's three main people in the story. So we've got Rose Zelonsky, we've got Ella Malley, and Dr. George Mitchell.
Okay.
All right.
Was Rose in your first love triangle?
It was.
Story?
It was okay. A Rose Ambler. So I think the coincidences and, you know, things happening are pretty interesting with Rose. I feel like Rose is a very popular name.
It is. Yeah, back in this year.
Yeah. Well, let's get to that at the time era.
Yeah. Okay, so perfect.
That kind of led into it. So we're in 1891 when this incident takes place. So Rose was a boarder of Dr. Mitchell. So she was a milliner. So that is a hat maker. So she worked for a shop in town. She was a local hat maker and she worked for Dr. Mitchell. Ella Malley, she was also about the same age as Rose. They're in their early 20s, 22, 23. Mm-hmm. And she worked out like the one of the local shops too. She was worked at a general store. Both, you know, in their church. Ella was like a good singer and she played the organ. So, you know, respectable young ladies. And one of their friends was visiting for like a year and she was going back to her original home with her family. Mm-hmm. So they were going to throw like a little party. So Rose at Dr. Mitchell's house, she had several of the other girls that they hung out with come over and she was like, you know, planning this out and invited several girls. So she was getting things for the party. So there's clerks in the trial. So there's going to be
a trial. It went to court.
Yeah. So they mentioned that she bought several strange things. So some things I would never expect to go together. So she bought a small amount of raw oysters.
Okay.
She bought some oranges and some chocolate creams.
Okay.
Okay. So that's you just keep that in your back pocket.
Oysters, cream, and
Oranges.
Oranges.
Okay. So not something I would put together.
Yeah, what meal is she making? Yep.
It's just like a little, and she asked a couple of the girls to bake some cakes. It was like, you know, just a little goodbye thing. Okay. I didn't understand the, maybe they have a different palette. I didn't mention where this took place yet. This is in, it is in Wisconsin.
Okay.
So we
which we have not covered yet.
No, we have not covered Wisconsin yet.
Teach in their own, 20s, I too, I guess, yeah.
Feeling like you wanted that. So we got to do a little backstory too. So okay. Rose has been a boarder of Dr. Mitchell's for a few years now, and she even was close friends with his wife, Mrs. Dr. Mitchell, okay? So Mrs. Mitchell had a baby in 1890, early in the year, I think February or March of 1890, and then within a month, she passed away.
Oh, was it related to pregnancy?
We'll get to that.
Oh. Oh, no. Okay. My head's spinning already.
Yeah. So she was suffering from convulsions, okay? So Rose would sometimes help, even though she wasn't, like,
the
a hired help or anything. Okay, well. She was just a boarder, so sometimes she would help, mm-hmm. you know, take care of. Because they got close, and, yeah, you know, they exchanged
living in the same house.
Yeah, they exchanged Christmas gifts, and, you know, they were okay. They're
a family,
close.
In a sense. Yeah,
right. So, and she had Mrs. Mitchell had another child. So she had Freddie, who was already about 10 at that time.
Okay, big gap, but
yeah. And then she had a daughter. Her name was Charlotte. So Charlotte's just a baby. So, you know, Rose is helping with that situation too. Mm-hmm. But she does end up passing away.
Oh, that's sad.
So, yeah, she was having convulsions, and they treat convulsions with chloroform, which I found was really interesting.
Ooh,
geez, so I'm doing some side research, like, why would you treat convulsions with chloroform? But I guess it was used as an anesthetic, so, like, it would dull your central nervous system. And kind of
what else is it dulling? Yeah.
Right. And poisoning you at the same time. So, so convulsions or chloroform death, we're not 100% on that yet. Okay.
Okay. All right. Oysters. So, poison. Giving a track record.
So we go forward. We're at this dinner party. So she invites, like I said, Ella's sister Lily also comes. So they're, you know, they have their dinner. So Rose at the dinner, she's there for like a few minutes, and she excuses herself saying she's sick. So she goes upstairs to bed. So she's up there.
Even though her friends are all downstairs.
Yeah, most of the night. So they had her saying she was sitting at the head of the table, and then on each side of her was each of the Molly sisters were, like, sitting right next to her. Okay. But then she goes upstairs. She excuses herself. She said she ate bad mincemeat pie earlier that morning and needed to go lay down. So they're like, okay, we'll go, you know, whatever. We'll talk to you later. And I guess she asked Anna McLaren, who was, like, one of their maids at the house, mm-hmm. to go and say she wanted to talk to one of the other girls. So she, that, like, the who the party was for. So she asked that girl to go up and say hi to her and bye. And then she's like, no, I want to talk to Ella, too, before she leaves. So then Ella went upstairs and was with her for a few minutes. No one knows what was said. Mm-hmm. And then she comes back down, and Ella and Lily play with Freddie, the other son, and they're, like, singing music. Aww. And then they stay till, like, 9 o'clock. But then Rose shows up again, and she's giving them chocolate creams. So according to Lily, Rose poured the creams into her own hands and then divvied them up between the sisters. And then the sisters, like, were eating them on the way home. So they both had one, and they were, like, perfectly fine. And then the next one, Lily says that Ella recalled it being bitter. She's like, this one tastes weird. And then Lily was like, oh, well, maybe it's dark chocolate. Maybe that one's a little different, you know, because it's
dark. Right, you
dark.
Don't know what you're biting into. Yeah, the dark chocolate.
Yeah, dark chocolate's a little more bitter. So she's not thinking nothing of it. And they're walking home. It's in the snow. They're walking. It's a few blocks to their house, right, at 9 o'clock at night in the snow.
Oh, no.
And then she says she feels like she's never felt before. And she's like, it's starting with my feet. And then Lily's like, what's going on? And then all of a sudden she feels like she's being suffocated. And then she's like, all right, Lily's trying to carry her basically the next half a block, because that's left, to her house.
Oh, no.
So she has to leave her there to go get her mother in the house. So there's another local doctor. Someone runs and goes and get Dr. Mitchell from the house.
From the boarding house. Yeah. So she just left.
Right. So there's two doctors there now, and they're at the house, and she's in between these convulsions she's having now.
What?
Yep. She's saying stuff like, I've never felt this before. She's asking God to take her because it was like
that bad. She was that scary.
Yep. She bit her own tongue and she was bleeding. And it was.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. All these witnesses gave different like
statements of what statements, she was saying and doing.
Yeah. So she ended up, they were giving her chloroform too to try and like dull the, the convulsions because they were really bad. And then by 7 a.m., she had passed away.
She passed? Really?
Yeah. She passed away.
I'm so quick to judge here. I'm going to keep my comments to myself, but.
It gets even crazier.
So because she's the only one who had two chocolates, her sister.
Well, no, they were both eating them. Oh, like they on both the way. Did. Yeah. She's like, Lily didn't recall how many she had on the way home, but she.
And how weird
never
that like, you're
sick.
Feeling ill, and then like all of a sudden you want to come down and just hand out these chocolates.
Right.
Okay. Tell me more. I need more detail.
Okay. So the next morning, the doctors are very concerned. And the second doctor's like, this looks like poisoning. Like, this is not a normal situation at all.
Just for from chocolates.
Yep. And the mother insists on an autopsy. So they did this.
In 1891.
1891. Okay. They sent her body to have an autopsy. And they looked at the contents of her stomach. And sure enough, she had strychnine poisoning. Strychnine. So it was readily available in the household because doctors would use that back then as well.
And she lived in the boarding house with the doctor.
Right. But so did a lot of other people who knew that that existed there.
Oh, and dear, there's another person.
Well.
Okay.
So.
Oh, that's sad, though, because she was only in her 20s.
Yes. Yeah, she was in. And I even found, like, they had a diary. Aww. Clipping like put in the newspaper of how like sweet she was. Aww, and upstanding. It was like I couldn't even read a clip of it. It is really, really sad. And her sister was devastated. Her mother, like, they said she was just the nicest person. And
shouldn't have happened to you.
Yep. She worked really hard. She worked like 14-hour days at the shop trying to save money, and she was taking classes at the college, and she was really, she had a bright future, but was snuffed out by, we don't, no one even to this day really knows what's
not
going
even
on.
You don't know the answer.
I don't know the answer. I've gotten all the clues that I possibly can, and in my mind there's still so many like
questions,
and it's all like he said, she said, they said. It's all circumstantial evidence, so there's no like smoking gun, so to speak.
Right, to actually find the evidence.
Right, because later, so she goes to trial, so they have...
So they're accusing...
She's arrested.
Okay.
She gets arrested.
The first suspect.
Yep, so she actually attends the funeral, and she causes a whole scene. She won't go see the body, and she's, like, has to be, like, carried out by a couple people. Yeah, so there's that whole thing. And then I guess she was asking questions, too. To people about like poisoning, and if people are accused of poison, how long they have to go to prison for. So that's what people said. Did she actually say that, or did they is it just like they want to find who did it, and they say, well, she got chocolate from her, so that must be
right. No, that's true. And then people
tested,
are desperate to
they
find
tested
the
chocolates that were left, and none of them had poison in them, but would it take just one? Like, and then there's stories from Freddie where, oh, my dad showed us how to put strychnine in cheese to poison the rats in the house. So, you know.
So was it Freddy? Like, not that it would have been Freddy, but maybe.
But, like, other people knew what strychnine did.
And how to insert it.
And insert it to make it a poison.
Oh, no. Because he's, what, 10, Freddy?
He's 11.
11.
Now, but.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, there's that whole story, too. So, Freddy seems like. He didn't like Rose very much either. But and then there's stories about other women who said that Rose was like trying to get them to talk to Dr. Mitchell in her favor before this all happened, that she was a good prospect for him to marry because
after his wife died.
Yeah. Because Mrs. Mitchell and her were such good friends that she even told Freddie that Mrs. Mitchell said within a month that he was going to, her husband was going to marry her.
That's an age gap there. I mean, that's got to be a big age gap.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, what's 12 years? Time. You know.
Yeah. It's the time. Okay. So it goes to court, but just gets dismissed.
Oh, no.
Trial?
Oh, no. Oh, so
okay.
They moved the trial because of all of the residents of this Richland Center. They had to go to Lancaster, which is in a different county, to get a fair trial, so to speak. Okay. But of course, juries back then were all men. Mm-hmm. Okay, so jury of your peers, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that eventually. But she gets accused, okay?
Yeah.
There's several people rumoring that, you know, like she had infatuation with Dr. Mitchell, okay?
Oh, okay.
So we get to the part. She gets arrested. She's in jail. They also want to exhume Mrs. Dr. Mitchell. Wow. And do some tests on her. So
see if it was the same poisoning.
Yeah. So they sent her like organs to be tested in Chicago with this forensic scientist of the day, and he found trace amounts of strychnine. Right.
Wow.
But her husband testified that he gave her Nux Vomica, which is another medication that has strychnine in it, to treat her convulsions. So the doctor at the forensic lab couldn't say for certain, it was a small amount. Did it decay over time? Right. Was it because it was a part of another medication that it was less than what it's?
Oh, geez.
But she also had strychnine. So
that's bad.
That's real bad. Doesn't look good for Rose at all. And the fact that she went to another doctor, Dr. Ludwig, also a month before, and said, hey, can you put in a good word for me, faking that she was sick. She was like, oh, I have a cough, I need to go see this doctor. And then she asked his wife to leave the room because she needed to talk to him about a private matter.
Really?
So he says that she wanted him to put in a good word. This Dr. Ludwig said, she said she was going to pay him $10 to do that. And he's like, did that happen?
Yeah.
But did it not? There's also a letter, though.
So some evidence.
So there's a letter supposedly from Rose with $5 thanking him for saying nice things about her because things have changed at the house and Dr. Mitchell was starting to pay her closer attention and
So she's saying in a good word so that he will become more interested in her for marriage after the wife.
Right. But he's talking to people and saying she's too spunky for him. He's like, she's a good girl. Everyone kept saying she's a good girl.
But
she's too much for him to handle or something. Sure. But, you know, he's a widower and she's a young woman. Like, what happened in real life?
The kids. And
right. But what really happened? Was he, having
affairs? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, who knows? She lived with them. So how hard would that have really been?
Right.
And so she's infatuated. She sees now this Ella is getting attention instead of her. So he's starting to say, well, yeah, you know, Rose is good and all, but I really have my sights set on Ella Malley.
And she probably, said she had to excuse herself at dinner to set up the scenario that she got ill, too, from whatever the other girl got ill from.
Right. That was my thinking, too.
And setting the scene.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't have been the one because I also got sick.
Right. Ugh. Yeah. So, she gets convicted. She is guilty, according to the court in Lancaster, Wisconsin, and she's put in prison because everyone at the dinner party was basically like, she was acting, you know, suspicious. She was like handing out chocolate to them only, and just, you know, it seemed really odd. Weird.
Yeah.
So
there's really no one testifying for her, like no right. witnesses.
And she's said several times in newspaper articles that she wanted to testify, but her counsel wouldn't let her. So from
maybe
the
so they knew the truth by or lawyer and
from her writing samples, she doesn't seem to be very well educated. Okay. So I feel like they didn't want her to
could've been deferential.
Yeah, to like yeah. Her words twisted, or because the prosecution could have, you know, yeah. really drilled into her or something. Who knows about like her feelings for Dr. True. Mitchell? Like,
yeah, and he in the moment she could have.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay. So they were just said
what.
You can't, so, but well, that comes to pass later, though. Like, years later, she's, like, asking for a pardon because she wasn't allowed to testify. Really? Yeah.
And was she granted that?
Well, we'll get there.
Okay, oh my gosh.
So
how much time has lapsed, like, from her arrested to
before? Not very long at all. Usually it takes years, right?
Yeah, you would think.
So, January is the incident.
Yep.
And she is on trial in June. Of that oh, wow. same year. So within 6 months, they've got all these people. And there's article after article after article. Every person who testified, you get like a snippet of a quote from their testimony.
Oh my gosh, it's like
about
it's like
this,
mine too.
Yeah, about this story and about their feelings about what happened and wow. about Rose. And, you know, she didn't have any family there. They had all already moved to Oklahoma.
Which doesn't look good for her.
Right. She was one of 9 children. And she was born in Wisconsin, but a few years earlier, like 1898, 99, her whole family moved to Oklahoma and she was alone. And then in 1890, like 4 of her siblings and her mother died of typhoid fever. Oof. So her dad had paid for her to come back because he wanted like her to help take care
support.
Of like take care of him and whoever was, you
yeah,
know,
was
what was
left
in the family. And she was like, No, thank you. She didn't.
She really not liked.
She didn't want to go to Oklahoma. Life. She liked being a hat maker in her life, and she was
must
spunky.
Not liked
I guess
it that much if she put herself in a ditch and.
Oh.
Okay.
So, we get to she's in prison. So her dad's just kind of didn't go support her at the trial. She had a cousin, I guess, mm-hmm. locally, but he didn't really show much. Support either, so she was kind of alone. You know, while she was in jail, though, there were several like newspaper editors and high ups like in the legal system who supported her. So she did have people who would go and like talk to her and try and help her through this. So one of them was named was Barnum, and he was an editor, and he had gotten a letter from a Minnie Braddock saying that she's got a whole different story about the going on with Rose and another woman. Okay. So
a lot of people in this yeah. story.
So Minnie Braddock is just like a pen name. That's not the person's okay. real name. We never actually find out. There's speculation. It's Anna McLaren, who was the hired help in the house.
Okay.
But her testimony paints Rose as negative, so I wouldn't understand why later on she would switch it and then say
yeah,
what she said in the letter, because in the letter she says that Ella Malley told her that she was very sad, she felt like Dr. Mitchell had ruined her, and that she was so sad she wanted to go to sleep and never wake up.
Oh, wow.
Basically,
depressed.
Like suicidal. This person was saying that Ella wasn't doing great because Dr. Mitchell and her had been intimate and had an affair. And this girl, this Minnie in the letter, also said that she had been with Dr. Mitchell and that she had gone to a faraway boarding house because she gave birth to a child.
Maybe his. Well, probably his.
Was the spinning image of Dr. Mitchell that she had given up for adoption.
Was the wife passed at this point?
Oh, that's like, this letter came like years after. Okay. Rose has been in prison because it's in support of Rose saying like she's innocent, let her out. And so this editor posted it, but he got in so much trouble. He got sentenced for libel for saying those things about her. So Mrs. Malley, Ella's mom, was like, you can't talk about my daughter after her death like that. Wow. When she can't defend herself. Yeah. And say that she was suicidal. That was a big deal. So
yeah. Wow.
They that,
and maybe if it was the person who the housekeeper, maybe she was negative before in the past, but then started to understand.
Or maybe he threatened her.
Right. Or, yeah, the pattern of him.
Maybe he threatened her and was like, if you say anything that this child is mine, like, I will come after you. I wish I knew if she had stayed in that house or, like.
Right.
And then the name that this girl had given at the, like, the birthing center, let's call it, was Isabel Shields. And no one could figure out, like, who Isabel, because she didn't give her real name when she gave birth and gave the baby up. So, and I did some research on the child. The child didn't live very long either. Aww. It was only like one or two when he passed away. So, I know. It's just like
crazy.
Kind of the spiral of negative, dark, crazy. Yeah. And then, so she's in jail until, let's say, there's a few governors through Wisconsin that she's asked for pardon by, and they're like, they review her case, so to speak, and she's thrown out, you can't get pardoned. So we get to 1897, and Governor Upton, he is like, it's his last month of office, so she like throws it out there, please pardon me. And it's literally the last thing he does before he leaves being the governor.
He's probably like, yeah, it's not under my hands. Something.
No, he said he reviewed her case and that because she wasn't given, the ability to give her own testimony in court, he felt like she was wronged and he let her out.
Wow.
So he lets her out, and then she ends up going to her cousins in the town over for a few weeks to get things in order, and her dad ends up helping her.
Okay.
And she goes to Oklahoma. So I also did.
So I was like, what, like 6 years, 7 years in prison?
Yeah.
By this point?
6, 7 years. Yep. So they said she had like withered away. She was very kind of, you know, just
in a bad state.
Yep. But she was happy to be out, you know, after being in there for so long. Mm-hmm. And Upham was the governor's name, pardoned her. So I'll read his quote. It has been the opinion of the greater part of the Wisconsin press, one editor wrote, that Rose was not guilty for the crime for which she was serving sentence. She was found guilty of murder in the first degree by a jury, which verdict was rendered after listening to a chain of evidence which was purely and wholly circumstantial. The State Register editorialized, the people of the state are nearly unanimous in the opinion that Miss Sildowski was innocent, and for those who follow the testimony and have judged from the circumstances surrounding the case and the trial outside of Richland Center are practically unanimous in the opinion that she is not guilty.
Wow.
So the governor's actions, you know, said that, see, she had a lot of support, but she also had a lot of people saying,
yeah, back then.
So it was, I don't know if she was he calling her spunky and he just didn't think like she was, did he do it? Like, because he gets married
following
year to someone who's like 15 years his junior.
Okay.
And has like 3 or 4 kids with her.
Wow.
So he's not like.
Yeah.
And he goes back. He's literally like buried in Richland Center. I found like in and his children with the second wife go and work for JFK and Nixon.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like,
well, that's cool.
Like upstanding people. So
well,
who knows, people in
politics. Oh yeah, right.
Maybe not.
There's also always a shadow, Michelle. Don't you know? Under everybody. No, that's really interesting.
And then, you know, you always want to see like how they like progress in life and like did Rose have a life after?
Yeah, like did she get over that? Did she just crumble?
So I found an obituary of her father
okay.
from 1912. And as of then, she was one of five siblings still alive. So they mentioned, like, oh, you know, her, all her brothers were still in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. And then they said Rose of Iowa.
Okay.
So didn't give a last name. So I didn't know if she gotten married. Bummer. And then I'm looking in Iowa. Iowa's vital records are sealed.
No.
So no. I literally, unless I was like a family relation, I couldn't get any more information. So,
okay,
I was,
so if, like, you are listening and have any information about this family, Zeldowski. Rose.
Did Rose have any children? Did she marry some nice person? Did she
go back make to hats jail?
Again? Did she? No, she probably didn't go back to jail because nothing was written after that. But there are so many articles. There's articles from as early as 1990 and 2006 where people are still talking about this article.
Yeah. Now, are those people from those states or just?
Some of them, one of them's from, like, D.C., and they wrote, like, one of them was about the finger was pointed at the wrong person, and they say kind of, like, what I was thinking, that the doctor was behind, because once you look back at, like, a wider lens, like, he had the opportunity to, the training, the knowledge, and maybe she, Ella was gonna say no, or Ella was pregnant, like,
right.
Who
so he got
knows?
The wife out of the could have gotten the wife out of the
way.
Could have gotten Rose out of the way because she was kind of getting upset about the attention from Ella.
Right.
But then why Ella if that's who he was after?
I don't know. Maybe she said no. Right. Maybe she was going because on her diary she was talking about school and she was quoting like poets and Greek philosophers. And maybe she had her own
dreams,
ambitions,
and desires,
and didn't want to be a doctor's wife. Like, who knows?
We will never know.
I know,
which is a bummer.
Right. But I loved this story so much. It took so much of my, like,
oh yeah,
my time,
because
and energy.
It's like the who did what, the when. You're trying to piece it together, and we both know when there's multiple articles it gets a little it gets a little crazy,
yeah,
because you got to sort through all of them.
And a lot of them are opinion, like,
right,
and like, whose opinion do you believe? And they said this, she said that. Like, were they really her friends at that point? No, because, but then did they really feel bad for Ella for what happened and they just wanted
someone to someone to get the fall for it?
I don't know. I really wish I knew.
Wow. So what does, so we don't know how long Rose lived for.
Nope, I can't find it. If anyone can help me with that would be phenomenal. I'm going to still look. I'm not going to give up completely, but.
Yeah, it does get hard at some point when you lose the dead ends.
Yep, because I looked on, like.
What you could do, although time consuming, is you got to go back and look through all the siblings that are still living. Find them. Did their obituary say?
I did that already.
You did?
I did that already. They didn't mention her. They only mentioned their children and their grandchildren.
Yeah.
So
bummer. Okay.
I lose her after 1912. I thought that I was like, and then I saw her name, Rose of Iowa. I was I wish they just gave me her last name.
And
then I could have done some more digging in Iowa. Maybe I'll just
records. And you couldn't find a death certificate for the dad because the records are sealed.
No, it was his obituary, so it was written.
Okay.
So
I was wondering if, like, his death certificate sometimes tells you who's the informant.
Yeah.
I wonder who handled his...
It was one of his older sons.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bummer. Okay.
Yeah, it's tricky.
Well, you keep digging. If you get an update, let us know. But, yeah, that's a good one. That ties into maybe some undetermined love scenario plus murder plus... poisoning.
I know.
I mean, you touched upon all of season one.
I was like, this one can go on any episode. Really, it was a little bit of everything and rolled into one. And I've only found it because I was searching for the word murderess, and it was in Rhode Island. I was searching in, like, one of the Providence Journal newspapers, and it was a tiny little 2-sentence clip about this Wisconsin murderess, Rose Zeldowski. And I was like, all right, I'll look at this. And then once I started looking in Wisconsin, whew,
opened up the floodgates.
Opened. And between her name and Ella Malley, each one has over like 700 article hits.
Okay. Now, you said there's photos, because my favorite.
Lots of photos of everyone.
Like real photo, like.
There's photos of Ella and her sister, Lily. There's a photo of Rose.
From 1891.
Yes. Photos. Photographs. And then
look at that after.
And then there's also like drawing renderings of the doctor, of the lawyers, of like this. Wow. I found one today that had a picture of his house. So we've got a lot of visuals for this one too. So
okay, yeah, enjoy. I will definitely be posting those. Well, thank you, Michelle.
Whew.
Whew, and I gotta follow that. Okay.
It's a doozy.
Alrighty. Alrighty here. Alrighty. So, I found a century-old newspaper article by searching love triangles, but I'm going to fast forward and then work my way back with the details. So, this one's from the Los Angeles Times in California. It was dated October 27th, 1996. So this is for the person that I'm considering the main person in my story, William J. for John Tiernan. It says, retired attorney, a resident of Southern California for over 30 years, died of heart failure on September 23rd, 1996, at the age of 74. Though born in South Bend, Indiana, he was raised in Flatbush, New York, and died like the true son of Brooklyn that he was on the handball court. Mr. Tiernan was attached to the British Army in Italy during World War II, volunteering to drive an ambulance with the American Field Service. After having graduated from Fordham University and Columbia Law School in New York, Mr. Tiernan began his law career in Los Angeles, clerking for Los Angeles Superior Court Judge John F. O'Connor. In private practice, Mr. Tiernan specialized in bankruptcy proceedings. At the time of his death, he and his son Peter owned the Sinclair Inlet Marina in Port Orchard, Washington, near his residence in Gig Harbor. In addition to his son, he is survived by wife of 49 years, the former Kathleen Langley, his sisters Irene Pettigrew, and Mary Clausen of Scottsdale, Arizona, his daughter Deborah Stucker of San Francisco, his elder son John of Gold Beach, Oregon, and three grandchildren and one great-grandchild. So, reading that, just hearing that, what would you say about this William Tiernan's life, just
had
overall?
A full, like, happy life. And
yeah, good career, wealthy, cultured from traveling. Yeah, so.
Had it all, right?
He had it all. It sounds like money. I mean.
Right.
So just remember that, because we're going to find out how he falls into this love triangle.
Okay. I'm ready.
Yeah. So the obituary does not mention his parents, which is sometimes normal. I feel like depending who's writing it, they might not know or might just not mention. It's not important anymore. But we're going to start with them. So we have John Patrick Tiernan, which is William's father, was born on St. Patrick's Day, 1890, in New York. He was from a prominent Staten Island family, and his father was Peter Tiernan, and his mother was Rosanna Mullen. And he graduated from New York Law School. And in 1914, he moved to South Bend, Indiana to be a professor for the law department at Notre Dame University.
Very cool.
Wow. You know, he's followed, you know,
prestigious. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Lawyers. So, and then within like a year of his career, he met his future wife on a New York Central train when she tried to raise a window and he stepped in to help.
Aww.
Yeah, very great. Very gracious.
That's so cute.
So they had a quick engagement, and on April 10th, 1915, John marries Christine Augusta Jasper, who's like nicknamed Gus. And she grew up in Bronson, Michigan, but was born in Indiana. And the age listed on the marriage record was that she was 19 and he was 24. The records show like a 4-age gap on the census and things.
That's actually pretty good.
Yep. So she was the daughter of a wealthy retired farmer, Louis Jasper, which also had like an AKA name of like Ludwig Drasqua, who immigrated from it. Either was like Poland or Germany, which my husband, who studied history, said it was due to the Kingdom of Perugia when it was like split and I didn't go too far down that rabbit hole.
Yeah. The families in my story were from Prussia. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. And her mother was Anna McCullen. Oh, sorry, Mikulski. So they get married. They welcome their first daughter, Irene, born June 21st, 1918 in South Bend, Indiana. Their second daughter, Virginia Mary Tiernan. She typically went by Mary on records. And then she was born August 15th, 1919 in South Bend, Indiana. And then the third child, William, nicknamed Billy, born on November 28, 1921 in South Bend, Indiana. So we have three children going on between mm-hmm. those two. Again, the first article I found was just searching love triangles, and I found it in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, published on September 13, 1922. You know, I like, you stuck yeah. to your time frames. Yep. I'm a little bit older. So the headline was, "Noted Indiana Love Triangle Transferred to Another Court." So like you, we're going to court.
Yeah.
Going to court. The case that they were talking about was the Tiernan-Poulin fraternity case. In 1922.
Oh, boy.
A legal dispute regarding the fraternity of a child. And which child would you guess they are talking about?
I don't know.
Out of the three, we had Irene, Mary, and William.
Maybe William?
It was the William that I just read that beautiful story about. He was this family's shadow because he was supposedly born to a, you know, the father was not Mr. Tiernan, not John Tiernan.
Oh.
So we're going to go back a little bit more and find out how we get here. So there's a little bit of trouble in the marriage around 1920 into 1921 because John Tiernan is full into his career. He's writing and publishes a textbook called Conflicts of Law, which he spent most of those years dedicated to doing.
Mm-hmm.
And an article I found, because like you, there was at least 30 to weed through. She states in quotes, "Husband too busy with career when she sought relaxation."
Oh.
Yeah. So he's busy. She seems to be wanting to be more social. Her other two kids are like past infancy and toddlerhood, so she maybe has more time on her hands, she's kind of saying, and she wants to go do dancing and, you know.
She wants to live a little.
She wants to live, yeah. She wants to live a little bit. Motherhood's hard, you know.
Right.
So in like 1920 is when the Tiernan family gets introduced to the Poulin family. They're in like the same town, and they just, you know, are also meet at social events. And it's in February of February 18th, 1920, to be exact, that they kind of have their first intimacy.
Oh.
So it's when they start their relationship. Before then, they were meeting at gatherings. They were, you know, just being social, but then it changed. So for about 6 months, they had this affair. Well, he probably didn't even know it because he's writing his book in his career. But she's going out. Mr. Tiernan lists that she's going out three times a week. She's saying she's either going to a movie or going dancing. So, you know, she's quite busy. She's meeting him. They usually meet at like a corner of a street and then go like walking or something like that. However, in August of 1920, Harry Poulin is his name. His wife goes to Chicago to visit her sick sister. And Augusta, John's wife, goes to their house, the Poulin's house, and a neighbor ends up telling on them because they saw them with the music playing in the house and probably whatever else. And they told the wife, I believe through a letter because she came home after, and of course questioned him. So he admitted to it, like, this is what's happening, whatever. So at that point, Augusta finds out she's pregnant, and there's like promises that like he'll send her roses and help take care of the baby and, you know, blah, blah, in person, right? Just between the two of them. There was one day after the baby was born, nothing had happened. He wasn't helping. They went to church, and Augusta became very upset that he was like ignoring her. So he goes home, she goes home, and Mr. Tiernan, John, starts like laying it in on her, like, what's going on? Why are you so upset? It just beats her to not beats her, but literally wears her down.
I was like, oh my
God, actually beats her. Wears her down so that she confesses about the affair. And like that the baby's not his, it belongs to Harry, who they're friends. Remember, right. they're friends, they go to each other's houses.
Social circles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was at that point in time, like there's a gap between when the wife of Harry actually confronted her and said, like, I know, you know, blah, blah, blah. So there's a gap in time where she just doesn't tell the husband until it has to happen, I guess. So they go decide that they're going to go to court. So again, the timeline, February 18th, 1920, they start this affair. It lasts about 6 months. In August, the wife finds out. And then in January 8th, to be exact, in 1921, he finds out, the husband. And the baby is born in November 28, 1921. So the timeline matches out from that side of things. September 3rd, 1922, Harry gets arrested and he gets released on bail for $2,000 2 hours later because they're pressing charges and they're going to court because they want him to take responsibility for the son. It's weird because John Tiernan, the husband, is representing his wife in court, which I don't even know how that could be allowed.
Probably didn't want to pay for a lawyer.
And he is a lawyer, I guess.
Yeah.
So he starts off going through the trial with her. And then at some point, it's quoted that he believes that he has fulfilled every moral obligation and is not called upon further to drag into the case the innocent person with who he is associated. So he stops the court case and they end up hiring another attorney. So that's fine. He still supported her. So he still went to the courtroom. He still did all of that with her.
But he wasn't, why were they even in court if he was supporting her? I don't understand.
So he,
like, well, the state brought the charges against her?
She did. She wanted Harry to pay. Like, okay. Why am I having this baby alone when it's actually your child too?
Wow.
Basically.
That's
deep.
That's a bit.
Yeah.
So she, and her husband was fine though, like he was supporting them, wasn't he?
Yeah, I guess. And there was one article where he had to like step out when he first got told and had to like compose himself or whatever, right. But he did try to, so as soon as he found out on January 8th, it took like a couple days to track Harry down, being his friend. He was like, I can't believe this happened, why would you do this to me? And he tried to settle it without the court,
right?
He wanted, just, I don't even need the money for me, just support your child. He denied it, and here we are in court.
Brother.
Yeah. And this was like a big court case for South Bend, Indiana. Like, there's pictures of the courtroom and like it is like so many people
packed in.
Yeah. And it took a long time. Like, we're talking like at least a full week of actual like full day trials. And like, you, there was a lot of Q&A. like, there was in the South, I think it was the South Bend Times, there was 3 full pages dedicated to this story. Yeah. And all
everyone's
back and
testimonies,
forth. Yeah,
right? And
they exactly
quotes. It was, yep, so much information.
And as it was called to the court, first they had like I don't want to say she's like a nurse who welcomed or helped support her while she was giving birth.
Yeah,
and she was the first witness, and you know, she kind of said like, you know, it's normal. Typically, she was a little sad, cried here and there, you know, but you're going through a lot,
right?
And then after that, Miss Tiernan got called onto court, and a pattern throughout all the stories were that she was so upset. I mean, she's having to put her whole life out there, right? And be patronized
all
for
it. All the dirty laundry.
Yeah, and there are times they say it's violent sobbing, like she can't even control herself. They have to pause so that she can actually take a breath to continue telling the story.
Like, how old is the baby at this point?
The baby, good point. So the baby's about 10 months. So there's actually pictures of the baby at that age. And they're saying it's like Exhibit A. He's nameless. Even though the birth certificate I found does say his name, William John Tiernan, does list William Tiernan does list the father John, but they're just saying, you know, like, we don't actually know his name.
She probably has postpartum too.
Yeah, exactly.
It's imagine that soon after.
And like, in the court.
Oh my goodness.
Like, the baby's in the courtroom. Why? Like, there's pictures of them carrying the baby into the court. There's pictures. There's like
proof, like, he looks like.
Well, that's what John said. So John was like, John said that the baby had a slight deformity. I don't know if it's in the hand, because I could kind of see something in the picture. They also said he looked like Harry, and Harry had two other sons where he had two daughters, and they looked like the sons. He said he had letters of proof. So there was just a lot happening, and the people, like, coming into the crowds trying to fight to get in to get a seat for the trial. People would bring their lunches. They had to, like, people were also, like, writing letters, some to, like, mostly to the Tiernan family, saying, like, the empathy sometimes for John. Also, like, hey, we want to adopt the baby, because they thought just because they're going to court, they don't want the baby. Right. That wasn't true. It was just they wanted to get what they, I guess, in her mind, deserved from support. So it was just, it was a lot of time in court, and the lawyers kind of were going at it at certain times. And what's interesting to me is that at one point in time, they consider a blood test. So this is 1922. Oh, wow.
See, Maury Povich.
Yeah, exactly. Are you the baby daddy?
This could have been taken care of
in an episode.
In like 5 minutes.
Exactly. So there's this guy, Dr. Albert Abrams of San Francisco, who has a system, he says, for establishing the percentage of
paternity.
Paternity. And I'll have to show you the picture later. There's like a picture of him with this like big device. It's like huge. But the court didn't grant it, even though Mr. Tiernan was trying really hard to get it to happen. Like, I don't understand why. Like, that could have just explained everything. So anyway, so they, you know, carry on court. After Miss Tiernan is on the stand, they call Harry's wife. She gets on the stand and has the alibi for him that, nope, they go to church every time together at this time and that time. And, you know, she's sticking up for him. And then
she literally had a letter.
I know.
Someone's, like, when she was gone.
Exactly.
So.
Oh, I know.
My goodness.
So there was that, and then they put a doctor on the stand. Just, they couldn't say, like, what they thought the parent was, but they just went over, like, the gestational timeline, and just to, you know, go over that. So there was definitely a lot of talk going on, and it took a lot of time because of, you know, the emotions going on. So they eventually get to a conclusion on the 30th. And let me just read it, because let me pull it up here. So, yeah, September 30th, the charges against Harry were dropped.
Hmm.
So, the judge believes that the story of Miss Tiernan and her relationship with Harry is true. He's not saying that it wasn't. But the judge totally disregarded the testimony of the absence of the relationship between John and Augusta. Like, I guess she went on stand saying, like, we haven't been intimate, so, like, I know that it's, like, how can it be John's, right? But then the court's confused, because he was like, well, why didn't John have any question in his mind? He's a smart guy. Why didn't he say, oh, this can't be my child, because we didn't, you know, we weren't intimate? So the judge is kind of using that against him to be like, well, he all along thought William was his child. So there was that, and then the judge went in saying, like, I didn't really believe Harry's story. It all just really came out to be that there wasn't enough evidence, I guess, to keep the court and decision going, so it was just kind of released. So, and the judge even went into saying that, like, he basically almost seemed, like, embarrassed that he even had to do this case, like, was the tone of it. And then all the while, it says he was staring at the baby, saying, like, the sympathy was really towards the baby at this point.
Yeah.
And the attorney for the Tiernan said, well, we're going to continue to do this. We're going to take it to the Supreme Court if we have to. We're going to try to get the blood test. you know, so they were gonna still keep going, supposedly. I never found any articles afterwards that they did. And, but then it still gets weird. So that's the whole case there. So there's an article from, I want to say it's now November. So the court ended in September. There's an article in November that, actually in between this, the professor resigns from Notre Dame University in November. Mm-hmm. He's going to now go to New York and practice law. He's filed a complaint for divorce towards his wife.
Oh, boy.
Even though, like, he supported her the whole time in court. And he's supposedly trying to get custody of the two girls, which I see going back and forth.
Right.
Like, he was going to let her have them, but now, you know, whatever. They put their home up for sale. Their home was on 1033 Diamond Ave. So they put that up. But he goes and tries to get married again. So he goes to try to get married, and
he's not divorced.
He's not fully divorced yet. So he ends up getting that marriage, the marriage he's trying to do, like, goes away because he can't actually do that.
Right.
And that was, like, quite quick after this whole case ended.
Hmm.
But then in 1930, they're living together as a family again. So
you saw that in the census?
Yeah, the census. Augusta, John, William, Irene, and Mary. So they're living together. And even in 1925, they're living together.
He just gave up.
I guess this is where we're going to just be together and do that.
Hmm.
But then in 1935, just before John's 45th birthday, he has a heart attack and dies, unfortunately. And then she goes off, Augustus goes off later and marries and lives. She marries someone named Schmidt, and she passes away at the age of 80 in Arizona. And her two children, other children live. I couldn't really find much on Mary, but Irene lived to 101 and moved to Alaska, and seemed like she did well for herself. Yep. And then now we know a little bit about, you know, how William's life turned out. And, like, knowing this now, reading that obituary, don't you have a different sense?
Yeah. Like, what was his childhood like?
Yeah.
Like, did his dad really, I mean, his real dad had nothing to do with him. And then how was his,
how did he get treated if
his not biological father didn't want him in the divorce.
And, like, did they ever get a real blood test and they just never probably not. Did he know about this story? Like, did anyone ever tell him about this? Did he have negative views about his mom because of the affair? Like, there's so many questions about the emotional part of what could have been for William.
Well, how soon did he move? He went to college and
he went to law school and everything, so you know,
did his own thing.
But that's the thing, like, under every it's the thing about life, right? You see something for at face value, but then underneath it, right, there's so much more layers.
So I feel bad for him. Law school, like, his
so John Tiernan, who raised William,
he
ended up going to college just as well to follow law.
So maybe
he was a good role model.
Too bad then, if you want to be like him.
Right.
What did Harry do for work?
So Harry Poulin he died at the age of 74. So he grew up in South Bend, Indiana. He died in South Bend, Indiana. And in 1930, he was shown living with his family, two sons, as an auto salesman.
Oh.
But during this whole trial, he was a clothes salesman.
Okay.
And it was even said, like, John Tiernan was so upset about, you know, the whole scenario, probably the break in trust between the friendship, that he's like, when this case is done, I'm going to expel him from, we're going to get everyone to, you know, expel him from the community. He's no longer going to be involved in this or that. And then Harry's obituary was like,
great guy.
Yeah, he was fine. Great. He did this and did that. He's in the Elks Club. Like, he carried on his life in the community where this all went down. So
John Tiernan seems more involved in, like, his work and didn't really put
and then,
much into this.
So a couple little notes, like, it just made me interested in, like, the paternity process, right? Like, in 1922, now we have the DNA.
Right.
That's, like, very
cheek swab.
Yeah.
That's it.
Boom.
Pretty quick.
I just wish, like, to your point with your story, like, we'll never know.
Right.
I mean, I have my conclusion. I do think, based off of everything, that it was obviously Harry. But, you know, imagine being William, and if you did know about this, like, really not knowing. There's people out there this happens to all the time.
You could probably see if, like, great-grandchildren of each side would do a swab.
Imagine. Okay, so if you're in this family, if you're in this family and have any information about DNA.
And, like, are you related to some...
the Poolins or... Yeah, no, it's definitely...
That would be one way to find out pretty quick.
It would, right? Yeah. Trace down the roots. Yeah. So, yeah, that was pretty an interesting story. And then to tie it in even further, my first love triangle story in season one was around Broadway.
Right.
And I found while researching that a theater group out of South Bend, Indiana, called the Acting Ensemble Stage Company performed and wrote a, there was a guy who wrote a playwright, and they performed a play called The Tiernan Affair in 2010 because they found this case so interesting. So
brought it to life.
Yeah, it brought it to life. And then when I was also researching, I like making connections. So sometimes if I see someone's like family tree, maybe I'll shoot a message over and just say, you know, do you know any information? Are you interested in talking? I met a man who was the assistant dean of Notre Dame Law School. And when COVID arrived, he was trying to engage the students and would write stories about the interesting past histories of people who were connected to the school.
That's so cool.
And Tiernan was featured. And he turned all his stories that he wrote into an actual short book called Storytime, The Complete Collection, Strange But True Stories of Early Notre Dame Lawyers. So you can find it's like on Amazon or Google, whatever. And I started just going through it. And it was really interesting. He had a very good summary of the whole story. And I believe he even mentioned that John Tiernan got like banned with his being an attorney or something because he did something that wasn't right and got disbarred kind of. So I didn't really look further into that, but it was cool to make that in that connection and just read other, like, it was like, oh geez, what's going on over there in the you know, the early days.
Salacious.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so that was my story. And again, we can't have a big conclusion, unfortunately, but I got pictures for days. I mean, pictures of John in the yearbook for Notre Dame, the baby. What I really wanted to find was a picture of Harry's kids. Yeah. So then I could look at, and a picture of William, because I don't have a picture of William any older than 10 months old. So I would have loved to maybe find those and just do some comparisons.
Right. See if they had any of the same features.
Yep. Exactly. So that's about it. This had so many details, so I'm probably missing some other good points, but. Interesting case.
Interesting.
Yep.
Yep. Both got to trial.
Yeah.
Over love triangles.
Exactly. Gotta love it. Well, awesome. Well, thank you for listening. We'll be back again. We're putting out episodes every 2 weeks, and we look forward to hearing from you and just making some more connections.
Yep. Thanks for listening.
Bye.